Slate. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we got a jammed up show for you today, but a very exciting and very important one. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking about Rise Up October and the upcoming events in New York City on October 22nd, 23rd, and most especially on the 24th, a day when thousands and thousands of people will pack into New York City, shutting it down, saying we will no longer stand for police brutality and the police murder of black and brown people. And over the next couple of weeks, we're going to be listening to some speakers from an event that happened in New York City on August 27th, when hundreds of people packed the First Corinthian Baptist Church in Harlem in order to take up Rise Up October, to talk with each other about taking us up. And people came together this night, families whose loved ones had been murdered by the police, folks from religious communities, college and high school students, people from the neighborhoods, activists, revolutionary communists, and many, many others. And they came together to put out the call and challenge, which side are you on? Where will you be on October 22nd to 24th? And over the next couple of weeks, we're going to be hearing voices from this meeting, and that's going to be a very powerful part of each show over the next couple of weeks. Before that, we'll be talking with Benny Anderson and Nadine Sanchez, who are the brother and sister of Johnny Anderson, who was killed by the police, by the sheriffs in Hawaiian Gardens on July 5th. And we'll be talking to them about their brother's case, the murder of their brother, and what they're thinking about that. And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to bring you a conversation I had with Orpheus Reed, who writes on environmental issues for Revolution Newspaper and RevCom.us. I had this conversation yesterday, and it's about Obama and his visit to Alaska and the nefarious schemes of all the overview of what the hell U.S. imperialism is doing in relation to Alaska and to the environment overall. So without any further ado, check this out. Over the past couple of weeks, President Barack Obama went to Alaska with a stated purpose of highlighting the dangers of climate change. Obama visited melting glaciers, an indigenous village along the Arctic coast, and met with fishermen, all to create public opinion for the U.S. agenda on climate change. That's the opening paragraph from a recent article by Orpheus Reed, who's a writer for Revolution Newspaper and RevCom.us. And I wanted to talk to Orpheus about this because we've spoken with him before about the sixth great extinction, about the situation with the climate crisis, what's going on in the world, the fights around that, and especially in particular in relation to the U.S. and its pillaging of Alaska right now in terms of drilling for oil in the Arctic and the rest of this. So I really wanted to bring Orpheus on to dig into what the hell is going on with Obama in Alaska and overall. Orpheus, how are you?
I'm doing great, man. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, you too, man. Well, let's jump into this so we can eke every bit of knowledge out of you in the half hour we have, okay?
Good.
We're going to squeeze you dry, buddy.
Go at it, bro.
Okay. Before we jump into the overall thing, into Obama's plan, I just recently read your article. Well, actually, your most recent article that was in Revolution Newspaper, as well as the one a couple weeks ago, dealing with this question of climate change, Alaska, Obama, what's going on. Before we jump into Obama's plan, I really like the way you opened your piece up, this most recent piece, with a pretty sobering assessment of just where things are at today, because I'm not sure people actually have that tight a grip on where are things at today in relation to the planet.
Yeah, I think that's very, very important. I think that the deeper you get into this and the more you really stay in touch with what's happening, honestly, the scarier it gets and the clearer that it becomes that we're really facing kind of an escalating and potentially kind of going completely out of control crisis. That really is where things are at. I mean, there's a whole bunch of different aspects of that, but just to talk about the climate, we're talking about this year is the warmest year since all records have been collected since 1880. So the warmest year in recorded history, right? And in many cases, these records are not just kind of slightly increasing, but they're really smashing old records. So you're seeing some real dramatic changes. You've seen wildfires kind of up and down the whole coast of North America, all the way from kind of like northern Mexico all the way up to Alaska. I mean, there was times in Alaska where there were over 700 fires burning at one time this year. And a lot of this has to do with this very, very terrible drought and also a real lack of snowfall this past winter. I mean, I know I'm in Washington State. In Washington State, there was, you know, in the winter, there was about normal precipitation. A lot of it, though, fell as rain instead of snow in the mountains. And then you had a very dry spring and a very, very dry summer. And so this is causing things like there is this article about salmon, you know, in the rivers of the Columbia, the sockeye salmon that were coming in. And this was really shocking to me. I mean, one of the statistics from the state wildlife authority said that it was expected that 80% of the sockeye salmon that were migrating into the Columbia River were going to die because the waters were too warm for them to exist in. So this is going on, and then you have just this going on all over the planet. You have the glaciers melting. You have ice sheets that are melting at both poles, right, including things like the West Antarctic ice sheet, which scientists said, I actually wrote on this too about a year or two ago, that the West Antarctic ice sheet is locked into a spiral of collapse, that it's basically past the point of no return where it's going to recover under the conditions that exist. And then you have, on top of this, you have this whole kind of environmental disaster kind of in motion happening. You have the sixth extinction, as I wrote about too, that many scientists are now saying we've entered the sixth mass extinction of species in the 4 billion year history of the planet. So these things are going on. You have tremendous changes in the ocean, fish being wiped out, whole species being wiped out and overfished and so forth, and then the oceans themselves being warmed and even chemically altered through the buildup of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which is changing the actual chemistry of the ocean. So the oceans are becoming more acidic, which has tremendous ramifications for sea life. So this is a very, very sobering situation that we're facing in terms of the changes that are happening on climate change, but also the environment in general.
As I was reading your article, you made a statement there about this could actually lead to an unraveling of world ecosystems for millennia to come. That's a very heavy statement to make. And what you're laying out here actually points exactly in that direction. This is leading into stuff that has never before happened in the history of the planet, as far as anyone can tell. And I wanted to ask you this. What's the U.S. done in relation to this? What's the U.S.'s hand in this in particular?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things. One on that, I would not say never in the history of the planet, right? Because there has been past times when the climate has been extremely warm. These are times way in the past before humanity existed on the planet. Mm-hmm. So there has been some of these natural changes as a result of huge changes in the environment. But what's happening now is caused by human beings, and it's never been seen in the history of humanity in its 200,000 years on the planet. So it's going beyond what we've ever experienced. And literally, it's not like you can warm the oceans and then change them back quickly, right? You know what I mean? There's been studies that have been done on the oceans, for example, showing that if we stopped burning fossil fuels tomorrow, that the oceans will continue to warm for a period of time and will stay warm for thousands of years. These things are set in motion, and they cannot be easily and quickly reversed. So you're talking about an extremely urgent situation. We need to stop this now. We need to stop burning fossil fuels, stop putting all this carbon and greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and we need a whole system change, too. In terms of the U.S., the U.S. is the largest single contributor throughout history to the buildup of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So the U.S. has poured more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere than any other country. You know, sometimes you hear they talk now about, well, China has surpassed the U.S. in terms of production of greenhouse gases. Well, that's true, and a lot of that actually is because China is producing for the whole world. I think it's something like 50% of the greenhouse gases that China produces, that China kicks into the atmosphere, are from production for other countries. So they're producing goods that are sold largely for consumption in the Western imperialist countries. So the U.S. is actually not today the leading emitter, but over history by far the largest contributor to the buildup of gases, the greenhouse gases.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Orpheus Reed. Orpheus is a writer for Revolution Newspaper and RevCom.us, and we're talking about Obama in Alaska and the crisis confronting the planet today. Orpheus, there's quite a few people who are paying attention to Obama going to Alaska. There's been quite a few people who have really cited this as sort of an example of Obama stepping out around the need to do something in terms of this whole emergency situation. Even he himself kind of spoke to it. He spoke to the U.S. role, actually surprisingly in a certain sense, in creating this dire situation that you're referring to and the U.S. responsibilities around doing something about all this. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that's true that he spoke to this in a certain kind of way that he hasn't before. And precisely what you said, he admitted kind of for the first time, right, that the U.S. has been a big cause of this situation. But the truth of the matter, and you know, we have to kind of look at, well, why is that, right? I mean, I think Obama does represent a certain kind of section among the ruling class, the people who run this country, who see the danger of climate change. They're not sort of the, you know, the Trumps and so forth that just, like, completely deny reality when it comes to climate change. On the other hand, they're really only capable of proceeding and going at this from the interests of U.S. capitalism and its domination of the world. And this is really concentrated in what Obama is doing right now and also in the actual changes that they're calling for. I mean, and there's many ways this comes out. You know, I was reading this stuff about, you know, one of the key ways that this is being implemented is the EPA power plant plan for cutting emissions, and they've put out that they're going to cut emissions by U.S. power plants 32% by 2030. And literally, these are, if you really look at the amount of changes that are needed, these are really puny in comparison to that. I mean, scientists have said something like 60% of the emissions from the developed countries need to be cut every decade. So these emissions are small compared to what's needed, first of all. They're also totally in keeping with the trends that are already present in terms of U.S. energy production. So if you look at this EPA plan, I kind of looked at it, it's like a 1,500-page document, right? So it's just like page after page of this bureaucratic stuff. But buried in that, really, and there was some articles that have been in this recently that I was reading, but buried in this is basically says that the whole direction in terms of these cuts that the U.S. is planning to make are totally in keeping with where things are already trending in terms of the U.S. energy production. So in other words, they're going to cut back slightly on coal. They're going to expand natural gas. So right now, coal produces about, I think it's 39% of U.S. power generation. They're going to cut it to 27%. Natural gas is 27%, so they're going to expand that to 33%. This is already what's going on, and it's expected at the end of these changes that they're putting out as these huge breakthroughs, coal and natural gas are still going to remain in 2030 as the two main forms of production of energy for the U.S. So these things are really in keeping with kind of the direction that the market is already determining of expanding more gas production and so forth. And the other really, really important factor is, okay, so why is he talking about this way? Why suddenly has he decided to do something after 7 years in office, supposedly doing something? And I think this does have to do with really how extreme this crisis is, right? And how much it's really escalating and how clear it's becoming to the entire world. So the U.S. has a lot at stake of really kind of packaging themselves now as being the world's leader on climate change. This is partly for public opinion, but it's also very important to sort of jockeying for position of all these different countries in the world, all these different capitalist powers who are kind of vying with each other over who is going to be the dominating force in the world. And it's shaping up now around particularly these climate talks that are happening this year in Paris, where the U.S. wants to package itself as the kind of number one fighter of climate change. And this has a lot to do with their ability to sort of dictate the terms of what comes next in the world in the face of this just horrendous disaster that's shaping up. They're determined that they are going to preserve power and remain on top, right? And this is one of the reasons we called this article Talking Climate Change to Preserve the System That's Actually Responsible for Destroying the Planet.
Yeah, very important. We're talking with Orpheus Reed, a writer for Revolution Newspaper and RevCom.us, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. Orpheus, you know, I wanted to step back for 1 minute. In terms of the stuff that you've been saying, it's really critically important. And one thing that really stood out to me in your article is this idea that Obama has made this assertion. Even as he's put forward this plan and they've put forward this whole way of saying to people, well, we're going to do this, we're going to manage the crisis and all this stuff, which actually is very different than we're going to deal with the crisis. But there's also been this point where he's actually stated that there's really no clash between drilling in the Arctic and fighting climate change. And that's one of those things where you feel like your head is being smashed against the wall. What? What's going on here?
Well, what's going on is just a bunch of hypocrisy, you know, hypocrisy and, you know, just efforts to cover up the truth. No, it is not consistent. if you are going to fight climate change, right, which needs to be done, there's huge things that need to be done right away. You would be talking about, you know, moving away from drilling for oil and natural gas in a major way. Under Obama, the U.S. has become the world's leading producer of oil and natural gas, right? You would be doing things like, okay, we're going to instantly and, you know, as quickly as we can bring forward green energy, and this coal is going to be left in the ground and so forth. They haven't done that, right? They've actually expanded export of coal under Obama, right? You know, he didn't lay out anything about this. He didn't talk about the extinction crisis at all. And he also, as you pointed out, right, he did not cancel, very pointedly, did not cancel his decision to open the Arctic for drilling. And it's been shown, right, by a study in Nature magazine and by scientists this year, said specifically, and this was the first time this has really been said, that it is entirely inconsistent to keep global warming from becoming a catastrophe and drilling in the Arctic, because the Arctic contains huge amounts of the world's remaining supplies of oil and natural gas. So that can't be opened up. Right? I mean, there's the danger of oil spills, which is another whole danger, which they're covering up the danger of. But it's entirely inconsistent to be both drilling for oil in the Arctic and to be saving the planet. So you got to ask. I mean, in fact, it was kind of interesting because in his weekly radio address before he went up to Alaska, it was put to him, or he felt he had to answer it because it had been put out a lot by environmentalists, like, this is hypocrisy. This doesn't fit together. And basically, he just said that these things are consistent and we're going to have to continue to rely on oil and natural gas for energy. I mean, he straight up said that, right? Mm-hmm. Which really shows that that is the heart of what they're continuing to do, even as they slightly change forms of that and so forth. But no, these things don't go together, and they're not at all consistent with dealing with the level of the emergency that we really face. And I think that's really an important point, because a lot could be done about this situation. A lot needs to be done, and a lot could be done, but it's not going to happen under this system. You know, we need a whole revolution, we need a different system, and we need mass resistance right now to really force the system to jump back off of what it's doing in terms of destroying the planet.
I'm going to ask you a little bit more about that in a couple of minutes, but I wanted to pursue this just a little bit more because, you know, I was really struck by a point that's made in your article where you say that even throughout this whole thing, throughout the entire approach, that they keep insisting that there's no contradiction between seriously addressing the destruction of the planet and the continued growth of world economies. And when you think right. about that, what the hell is, you know, it's like the world economies are growing because they're raping the world.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, he said that straight up, that it's totally consistent to fight climate change in a meaningful way to save the planet and for the world's economies to continue to grow. So you're like, okay, what is your evidence for that? Well, his evidence was that the world economies grew this past year, but carbon emissions, for the first time in a long time, did not grow. In other words, they didn't really decline much. They just didn't grow. They flattened out a little bit. I mean, this is ridiculous as a claim. I mean, if you look at the whole trend of, I mean, I look today at the growth of carbon emissions from, you know, about 1950 to the present day, and it's not a straight line increase. It's like almost basically a huge increase over this time. Every year there's not an increase. Sometimes years of carbon emissions are more or less the same, but the trend is clearly upward, and the trend in terms of the growth of the world economy too. So these things go together. The growth of the world economy is fueled by fossil fuels. That's the whole energy foundation of the world, right? And it also is at the same time that it's finding more and more sources of fossil fuels and digging them up in this intense competition between different world powers for control of these things, because you control the world economy if you get a hold of them. At the same time, it's also no planning in terms of the way agriculture is done, in terms of protecting the forests, which are very key, and there's, you know, massive deforestation that continues around the planet. That's just an outcome of kind of the dog-eat-dog and the competition and the search for profitability kind of relentlessly by this system. So none of these things are consistent, really, with fighting the climate. And he's just really, you know, I think there's really a thing of trying to pull the wool over people's eyes to cover up what is really happening and to kind of buoy up this thing that we can rely on the system and we can rely on sort of the some of its enlightened representatives to do something about it, which is really just not possible.
We're talking with Orpheus Reed from Revolution Newspaper and RevCom.us. Orpheus, you know, there's a point here when you were talking earlier about where this all comes from and what's pushing this? What's the dynamic? What are the forces behind this, the big factors behind the assault on the planet by the U.S.? And one of the things that really struck me, I mean, I remember reading this just as he was beginning his trip to Alaska, and there was an article, I can't remember whether it was in the New York Times, the L.A. Times, somewhere, Washington Post, maybe in all three, maybe everywhere. But the point was, is what they said was, well, you know, going along with this is the idea of more icebreakers for the Arctic. Here we are. You and I have spoken about this, the melting of the ice, all this other stuff that's going on. And he's saying, we got to bring more icebreakers in here.
You know, in fact, this was the only new proposal that came out of the Alaska trip. The other stuff was just what he had said before, that, you know, we're going to cut 32% by 2030, the power plant emissions, et cetera. So no other new proposals. It basically amounted to kind of a photo op to try to package this whole U.S. plan and how it's serious about climate change and really position the U.S. for, you know, for these upcoming climate talks to be seen as the world leader. And remember, these things are important. They're important to kind of like public opinion in the world, but they're also important, you know, to try to make it look like U.S. capitalism, U.S. democracy, of course, as they call it, is really the world leader on this and to keep its legitimacy. But yeah, that's the only concrete thing that was announced when he was in Alaska, that they were going to build more U.S. icebreakers. And this is also fully consistent with how the U.S. is seeing the Arctic, how it's approaching it. And really, this is a situation of, on the one hand, here they are, this system has melted, you know, Arctic ice so that, you know, a lot of the animals in the Arctic and also the people in the Arctic, the indigenous people in the Arctic, are driven to the point of devastation and threat to their whole future. And here they are, instead of protecting this and stopping the further growth of burning of fossil fuels, they see this as an opportunity because the Arctic is rich fields of natural gas and oil and so forth lie under the Arctic Ocean. So they're jumping on the situation, and they're also like really seeing it. All the big powers, the U.S., Russia, Canada, Denmark, the Arctic powers, but also China is trying to get into this. You know, they understand that there's a whole race for control of this region. So part of it is, you know, the question of who is going to gain the resources of this. And, you know, the U.S. and Russia and Canada are really stepping that up on the one hand to get, you know, drill for these fossil fuels, et cetera. But also they see it as like who's going to really be the militarily dominant power in this region, right? And so this is what the icebreakers are about, really, you know, increasing the U.S. ability to project power into that region. And, you know, I've written on this, and in this article speaks about it, this latest article. Also, there's another article that I wrote called Why is the U.S. Opening the Arctic to Drilling, which is also on RevCom.us. People can look it up, that kind of goes into this whole thing about the strategic importance of the Arctic to the world powers, especially to the U.S. And, I mean, this is something that for a number of years, a lot of things like the, you know, military advisory boards have been telling, you know, telling kind of the powers that be, telling the people running this system that we need to be able to expand U.S. national power into that region, that this is something that has to happen. And this has nothing to do with protecting the Arctic. It has nothing to do with protecting the peoples of the Arctic or protecting the planet. It has to do with the U.S. remaining on top, remaining kind of the number one military and economic power in the world in the face of what is a catastrophe.
All right, Orpheus, we have about maybe 4 or 5 more minutes left, and I wanted to ask you this. You started to talk about it earlier. What's it going to take? You talked about the need for critical resistance in your article, and you've also talked about what it's going to take to actually really fundamentally change all this, to stop this and recover what we can and build a whole new world that'll thrive.
Yeah, this is extremely important because, you know, like I said, this is a very daunting situation, and we have to face the reality of how daunting and what we're up against. But it is extremely important that there is an actual way out of this crisis. There is a way we can deal with it. Now, I think that starts with resistance. Resistance is really critical, and there has been important resistance, you know, that started to develop around the Arctic drilling and in other ways around the environment. And this is very important, what's happened. But this really needs to take a leap, and I think it needs to take a leap, and it needs to aim to really draw in millions and millions of people, all those people who really care about the planet and the future, you know, all those people who care about the world, bring them into really determined resistance where people are really opening their eyes to what we're up against and not continually kind of coming back to thinking, well, we'll just change it by pressuring the powers that be. That's the best we can do, right? Instead, this resistance really needs to force the system to jump back off of their destruction. It needs to build up people's strength. And this has to be aimed at stopping this stuff. We've got a raging crisis in the world in terms of the environmental destruction. It's increasingly out of control. It threatens to become completely out of control. It needs to be stopped. This is urgent, right? So we need mass resistance right now. But to fundamentally stop this, we need a revolution. We need a whole new revolutionary socialist system that will interact with the environment in a completely different way, a system that's moving towards communism, to getting rid of all class distinctions, inequalities, and to saving the planet, and a system that's not based on ruining the planet and exploiting humanity. All these things are possible. There's a whole vision for how this new system could emancipate humanity and, you know, preserve and protect the natural world, work to stop its destruction, work to repair what can be repaired, allow nature to come back and aid it wherever we can through things like, you know, initiatives to regrow forests and other plants to protect, you know, ecosystems and so forth. And, you know, on that, I think there's a real importance for people to check out the special issue of Revolution newspaper on the environment at revcom.us. You can just go there to revcom.us and you can put in environment and the special issue will come up, because one of the things in there is like a section on the sustainable principles for socialist society and development that could really meet the needs of the people, but not based on profitability or, you know, based on advancing the competition with other powers. So that's very important. And there's also, I want to say, there's also like a whole constitution for a new socialist republic in North America that speaks about defending and protecting the environment as a central part of really how the whole economy would function. And people can also find that on RevCom. And, you know, further, even in a bigger scale, there's a whole strategy for making this revolution and a vision of a new society that Bob Avakian, who's the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, has brought forward. You know, really like a whole new synthesis, the kind of world that people would want to live in, the kind of world where people are both emancipated on the one hand, and also we're protecting and preserving the natural environment. So I think people should really dig into those things, you know, and dig into that vision. And, you know, very clearly, we can't wait. You know, I'm not talking about, well, we should just wait for revolution. I'm saying we need to fight. We need to resist right now. Step that up.
Yeah, exactly. All right, Orpheus, we're going to have to cut it off now. As hard as it is to do that, we're going to have to cut it off, man. But I also want to let people know that the name of that particular special issue of the paper that you were talking about is State of Emergency, The Plunder of Our Planet, The Environmental Catastrophe, and The Real Revolutionary Solution. And you can download the PDF of the full issue of that paper on revcom.us. So, Orpheus, thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thanks a lot, man. I do want to say people can find me on Twitter, too, at Orpheus Reed. That's O-R-P-H-E-U-S Reed.
All right.
Thanks a lot, man.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye now.
Bye.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Orpheus Reed, writer for Revolution Newspaper and RevCom.us, and we've been talking about Obama, Alaska, and the assault on the planet. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. All right, welcome back. That's Don't Let Them Get Away with Murder from Jasiri X. All right, on July 5th, this summer, Johnny Anderson was relaxing with his wife in the backyard of a vacant house in Hawaiian Gardens, California. He happened to see L.A. County sheriffs approaching, and he started to walk away from the cops. They chased him and murdered him in cold blood. That's right. They chased him and murdered him in cold blood. Never forget that. Here to talk with us about Johnny Anderson, what happened to them, and they're fighting against this, against what happened to the brother and against the kind of genocidal slaughter that's happening across this country. I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Benny Anderson, who's Johnny's brother, and Nadine Sanchez, who's Johnny's sister. Benny, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Mike. Good morning.
Good morning. Nadine, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Why don't we start with you, Benny? Why don't you tell us what actually happened to your brother on July 5th?
Well, just like you stated, he was in a vacant house. He was approached by the police, and then, you know, he knew he was, you know, he was trespassing, you know, and he didn't want to go to jail. So, he jumped the fence, and they decided that we're going to chase you down and we're going to kill you. And that was totally wrong. He was unarmed. He didn't have a shirt on. You know, he's, you know, a nonviolent person. You know, he's a funny guy. I'm standing right here in front of his grave site right now.
You're standing in front of his grave?
Yes.
Yeah. Wow.
Because, I think that, you know, as an older brother, you know, I got to speak for him because, like, he can't talk no more. I'd like to say this to the audience. Like, before all this happened to me and my family, like, I used to see it on the news all the time. I mean, it's happening all over the country. Unarmed person getting gunned down by the police. You know, I used to think, man, that's really messed up. How can these people do this to a human being, you know? Mm-hmm. I never thought that, you know, well, what can I do about it until, you know, it actually happened to me and my family. Mm-hmm. So I'm encouraging everybody that's listening, don't let it hit home. I mean, because it can happen to anybody, God forbid. Listen and support. Do some research. Like, I've been doing a lot of research and reading, you know, about situations across the country, about these murders by police. And, you know, that's wrong, you know. That's wrong to take a human life just like that, just because they can. That's my view on it.
Yeah. Nadine, why don't you tell us a little bit more about your brother, who he was, what he did, where he lived?
Yes. Well, my brother was an awesome brother. His smile could light up a room from a mile away. He would do anything for us. He would take off his shirt for anybody and give anybody anything that they needed. That's just the kind of person that he was. It took a hard hit to all of our family because we lost somebody very special to us. Like my brother said, we're here to speak on behalf of my brother because he has no voice, and we're here to be his voice for him. The police are labeling us like we're nothing and killing us like it's nothing. Everyone's life counts, and our brother's life did count, and he should be here with us today. It's dehumanizing. They're labeling us like we're nothing, and we need to put a stop to that. And that's why also I feel that we should contribute to Rise Up October on October 24th in New York City. You know, we need to be the voices of Johnny Ray Anderson, my brother, and Michael Brown, Eric Gardner, and Ezell Ford. We need to take a stand, and we need to put a stop to all of this. I'm tired of the police covering up and saying their story and their side with what they want people to believe, but we're here to tell the truth about what happened to our brother.
Great. And it's really important. And we will talk more about Rise Up October as we get along in the interview. Benny, let me ask you this. The cops say that your brother ran and he reached for a gun. He reached for the cop's gun, that he got up and leaned over the fence and went for the cop's gun. I read in both the LA Times and a couple of other places where actually there was a witness that said your brother was empty-handed and 20 feet away from the cop when the cop shot him.
You know what? I don't want to comment on those things, but the guy was unarmed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's happening all over the country. You know, my brother was unarmed, for one. Two, if they initiated the approach on my brother, and let's say he took off running, he want to get arrested. Hey, you know, actually, I mean, their tactics are like, well, we're going to hunt you down and kill you. I mean, come on now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a human being.
Yeah.
As far as him reaching for the gun, I mean, they're going to save face. They're not going to cause havoc in their department, in their tactics. They're not going to admit to it. They're going to have to say, well, the last resort was, well, he reached for the gun. Why wasn't that said in the beginning?
And that's what they always say it everywhere. They always say, he reached for a gun. He was going for me.
Yeah. And then even this day and age, like, we're getting a lot of this stuff on video and stuff like that. Fortunately, we didn't have none of that. So it's the cop's word. And their word is like, it's like gold. Whatever they say, when it gets down to the prosecutor and the district attorney, whatever they say, they're going to believe them. They're not going to doubt them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then another thing, I'm like I told you earlier, I've been doing some reading. A lot of these police, they kill somebody, and then they put them behind a desk with pay, and then they release them back out on the street, and then they kill somebody else. So what is that telling you? What about this police, these tactics, and this organization? You know,
mm-hmm.
There's something that needs to be done. For this man to kill my brother the way he did and then still be getting paid, I mean, it's just hard for me to comprehend. Like, you know, like, there should be something in there. Like, if you killed an unarmed person, you're automatically dismissed until we could figure all this out. Not, okay, we're going to put you behind a desk and, you know, put you behind a computer and then later on phase you out back into another department so you could do the same thing over and over. You know, that's my view, you know, like... Something's got to change, you know, because, like, let me give you an example. Let's talk about the mentally ill a little bit. Okay, not even 12 hours later, the same sheriff station, Lakewood Sheriff Station, California, not even 12 hours later, murdered another guy in Lakewood. You know, this guy was having a breakdown. He hasn't had his medicine in 2 days. His brother was there. His brother actually called for assistance, you know, and they sent the police out there. In a matter of minutes, their loved one was killed. They just sent a hit squad out there. Mm-hmm. Forget if he's mentally ill. Forget what he's going through. But when we file grievances, the officer was having a bad day. Mm-hmm. You know, so I mean, if it applies to them, why can't it apply to us when they're doing their thing? They just sent a hit squad out on this guy.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Benny Anderson and Nadine Sanchez, the brother and sister of Johnny Ray Anderson, who was killed by the police in Hawaiian Gardens, California, back in early July. Let me ask Nadine something for a minute. Nadine, when you think about that, this idea that they've said that your brother was killed because, you know, we went after him because we found out he was named on a gang injunction. What do you think about that?
Well, I just think it's unfair and it's dehumanizing. The gang injunction is a bunch of BS. It's just basically to control and install fear in all of us. And it's not right. We need to do something about that. We have to think about the future of our children also that could be placed on this gang injunction. I mean, it's just ridiculous. You can't be out past a certain time. You can't ride a bike. You can't ride a skateboard. You can't be around other people that are also on the gang injunction. It's just all these rules and all these things just to have control over us. That's part of the reason why my brother also ran, because he was in fear of going back to jail over the gang injunction.
Yeah. Now, you said that you've been thinking a lot about Rise Up October. And for people that don't know, Rise Up October is going to be, it's going to be a day that brings together, I mean, it's actually part of 3 days. It's going to be on October 22nd. There will be powerful demonstrations in cities across the country for a national day of protest to stop police brutality, repression, and the criminalization of a generation. And the many lives stolen by killer cops and the system that backs them will be featured in these kinds of outpourings and demonstrations, bringing to life the devastation that people like and families like Nadine and Benny are facing that's been inflicted on them by the police. On October 23rd, there's going to be nonviolent direct action in New York City that involves well-known people and targets an institution that concentrates the slow genocide of police terror and mass incarceration. And then on October 24th, there are going to be thousands and thousands of people who will descend on New York City from all over the country to deliver a message that police terror must stop, shutting it down by the sheer weight of their numbers. Now, Nadine, what made you want to take up October 24th, Rise Up October? Why do you think Rise Up October is so important, and what made you want to take it up?
It's important to me because, like I said earlier, we need to be the voice of my brother, not only for my brother, for justice for my brother, but also for all the other families out there and all the other loved ones, like Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Ezell Ford. There's so many other families out there that are suffering just like we are, who have lost their loved ones. And it's very important that we get the word out there for Rise Up October, you know, to come together, to put a stop to this, mm-hmm. to come together and be strong so we can make a difference.
All right. Benny, what about you? Why is Rise Up October important in your eyes?
In my eyes, it's a good thing. Like, across this country, you hear very little about other states and what's going on. And I mean, unless you're really digging yourself, but, like, there's so many families and loved ones that have been murdered by police, you know, unnecessarily. No, this has got to stop, you know. And Rise Up October, this is a way to get heard and to show the world, hey, look, you know, look what's happening. You might not see it every day. I mean, locally you do, but I'm seeing in other states and stuff like that. We need to do something about it. And we encourage everybody to get involved.
Now, one other thing. Is there anything happening, any more happening, in relation to the murder of your brother?
Like I said, it's still under investigation. I mean, you know, we have a lot of things going on with the lawyers and stuff. But as far as that, I mean, this sheriff's department, they're having, I mean, from the gate, you know, they just say, well, he's just a John Doe, you know. Mm. Other things they did to me to cover it up. But I don't want to speak on that right now until the lawyers actually do what they got to do, you know, and then make it public, and then I'll feel free to, you know, speak on that. Mm-hmm. But they haven't given us no answers. I mean, we had a town meeting right here in the city of Hawaiian Gardens, and, you know, there was like, all the homicide, the captains, the watch commanders, and down to, you know, the regular deputies. And, you know, they told us, well, it takes 6 months for this, it takes 6 months for that, it takes 6 months for this, and 6 months for that. You know, and what about us? You know, we want to answer. This is our loved one, our brother. Mm-hmm. You know, what about us? You know, what about the people?
Mm-hmm. All right, Benny, I'm going to ask Nadine one final question. And Nadine, I want you to think about this. You're speaking to many thousands of people right now. What would you say to them? What do you want to say to them from your heart about what's happened with your brother and about, again, why they should come out to the Rise Up October?
I just want to let everybody know the truth about my brother and what happened to him. Just to let all the other family members know, hey, you're not alone. I understand how they feel. We're going through it just like they are. And you know what? Now's the time to take a stand and to come out to Rise Up October and just to unite and put a stop to this.
All right. Nadine Sanchez, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Benny Anderson, thank you very much for joining us today. Do you have anything you'd like to say about why you think people should definitely be out there?
Like I said again, you know, Rise Up October, this is a chance for many thousands of people to let the world know that, hey, we're not going to put up with this anymore. This has gone too far. I mean, every day it's happening in this country, you know, every day. We might not hear about it locally, but it's happening every day. It can happen to anybody, God forbid. What I got to say to the people who are listening, get involved, get involved. If you don't agree with some aspects of Rise Up October, do some reading and get some facts. You know, about all these people that are getting murdered across the country by the police.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much, Benny and Nadine. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you.
All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Benny Anderson and Nadine Sanchez, and they are the brother and sister of Johnny Ray Anderson, who was relaxing with his wife in the backyard of a vacant house in Hawaiian Gardens, California, on July 5th, when he saw L.A. County sheriffs approaching. He walked away from the cops. They chased him and murdered him in cold blood, shooting him in the chest. They also then later arrested his wife in the aftermath of it all, and she didn't find out until the next day that, as the cop told her, he didn't make it. That's what this is all about. Teddy, we're going to come back and talk to people about something, but I want you to play a little bit of track four for a minute, all right? Welcome back. I just had to get that out there because it was sitting in there in my head and just busting to get out, all right? That's right. You got it. It's Police on My Back from The Clash, all right? Now, on August 27th, hundreds of people packed the First Corinthian Baptist Church in Harlem, New York City, to take up Rise Up October. People came together this night, families whose loved ones had been murdered by the police, folks from the religious community, college and high school students, people from neighborhoods, activists, revolutionary communists, and many others. And they came together to put out the call and the challenge. Which side are you on? Where will you be on October 22nd to the 24th? Get organized. Come to New York City. Come one, come all. Be part of standing up and saying no more. Change history. Over the next couple of weeks, we're going to be featuring special segments built up around October 24th, Rise Up October. And these are going to be featuring people who are involved in building for it, victims of police murder, police brutality, their families, and all kinds of people who really want to make this, who really want to make this a day where things turn around, where a very sharp dividing line is drawn in society, and we're able to stand up and say, no more, we will not tolerate it. This stops now. So first up, we're going to be bringing you the voice of Reverend Jerome McCory. Check this out.
I'd like to introduce the Reverend Jerome McCory. Yeah. Reverend McCory is a civil rights leader. He is one of the faith coordinators of the Rise Up October initiative, and he is a leader in the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And he and his wife have come all the way out here from Dayton, Ohio. Please, let's give it up for Reverend Jerome McCory.
Thank you so much, brother. There is a reason why you are here tonight. There is a reason why all of us are here. We are here because if you are in fact not a part of the solution, you are part of the
problem.
If you are not a part of the solution, you are a part of the
problem.
If you are not a part of the solution, you are a part of the
problem.
While we were in Ferguson doing the national tour, they have an acting chief of police who happens to be an African American. We had just finished a press conference across the street from the police department there in Ferguson. And there were a group of mothers whose sons had been victimized by the police who were roasting a pig. Now, I had said I wasn't going to eat no more pork. But they had written the name Darren Wilson, the officer who killed Michael Brown, on the skin of the pig, and I could not resist myself. Allow me to confess, I ate some pig that day. It is time that we begin to identify what role we're going to play. But that chief of police, that acting chief of police, walked over to me after I spoke at the press conference, and he said real softly in my ear, "You mean, Reverend, but I'm really on y'all's side." Well, he was right. I didn't believe him then, and I don't believe him now. And I say that because, if you'll allow me just for 30 seconds to be a man of faith, there is a story that I remember they taught me when I was in seminary. I don't remember everything, but I remember a story or two. It was about a prophet. And if there's anything missing in the religious community, Reverend Phelps, it's we lack prophet preachers. Well, we got a whole lot of folk that talk smack. We got a whole lot of folk that do a lot of things, but we lack prophet preachers. Well, there was a man they told me about in biblical times named Ahab. And they said Ahab challenged the order of the day. 450 prophets of Baal. He said, "I'm going to let y'all go first. Y'all call on Baal. I'll go when you get finished. And I'll call on God. And the one that answered by fire, let him be God." You biblical scholars know that story. But here's the part that often gets overlooked, and it takes a prophetic word to understand it. After the 450 had gone and prayed for a good long time, Ahab stood up by himself. And he said, "Now I'm going to do something different." But the first thing he did was he tore down the old altar. What I'm trying to say is, some of y'all want to fix the police by becoming the police. You can't fix policing until you destroy the altar. Somebody ought to say it with me. Solution, revolution. Solution, revolution. Solution, it's a system. And you've got to destroy the old system. You can't just keep adding new garment or a new cloth to an old wine sack. You got to change some stuff. And that's what this move is about.
All right. Once again, that was Reverend Jerome McCory, who is one of the organizers of Rise Up October. Now, I also want to bring you another voice who's been very, very involved in this, who's been very much a part of the Rise Up October, of the fight against police brutality and police, you know, the genocidal assault on black and brown people that's been going on all across this country. And his name is Noche Diaz.
Noche Diaz is as real as they come. He's as real as they come. And I'm going to tell you a little something about him. He is part of the New York City Revolution Club. All right. They love you, brother. Now, Noche is known among the people as a fighter for the emancipation of humanity. And to the NYPD, as a leader to watch. In the next 6 weeks, Noche is scheduled for trial on serious misdemeanor charges, from leading the first New York City protest when Mike Brown was killed, for being in protest when Michael Brown's killer was not indicted, and for leading a protest across the Brooklyn Bridge for shutdown April 14th. Like I said, this brother is as real as they come. And so, friends, I invite you to join me in welcoming Noche Diaz.
All right. Spend the rest of this night trying to answer the charges in that introduction. Look, let me just say straight up, I have endorsed the call for Rise Up October, and the Revolution Club will be building for this from our perspective of getting society ready, preparing people, preparing a leadership core to put an end to this system that is responsible for this. This has got to stop. This is why, you know, we got these shirts on that say Bob Avakian speaks revolution, nothing less. We're talking about going up against these monsters and taking this system down while not becoming the monsters that we're fighting. Speaking of monsters, we're coming up on the 60-year anniversary of the murder, the lynching murder of Emmett Till. I remember when I heard Bob Avakian tell this story of Emmett Till when I was 15 years old. I had tears coming down my cheeks. When I heard about Mamie Till preparing her son to go down to Mississippi, and I heard the echoes of my own mother and my own family telling me how I have to walk the streets right here in New York, in the Bronx, and, you know, to not be seen as a threat, to not be seen as a criminal or a thug. Or look at the echoes of this in Freddie Gray, hunted down by the police in Baltimore, beaten to a point where he was killed for looking a police officer in the eye. And what about the other youth in Baltimore, growing up with boarded up buildings and foreclosed futures? Even the kids. A 5-year-old girl I met down there made bracelets for her grandmother to hand out in the neighborhood because she remembered Freddie Gray used to buy her ice cream and play with her, and she wanted people to know that she misses him. An 11-year-old kid had to be pulled into the administrative office to answer all kinds of questions and explain to them the reason he's with the Rev Club is because he's tired of seeing people beat and murdered by these pigs. Those are his words. Or what about just down the street? Youth I just talked to a week ago, 23 years old, talking about facing years in prison and having all the people he grew up with missing because they're locked down from raids that were carried out in the Manhattanville and Grant homes and Manhattan Avenue, where over 100 people were swept up. Not one piece of evidence of any crime. No drugs, no weapons, no bodies. They all knew each other on Facebook. I even talked to a young woman who had an assault rifle pointed in her face when the police busted in looking for her brother. And since they couldn't find him, they dragged her away instead. The echoes carry forward. Speaking of women, I've talked to women in Baltimore who, you know, talk about being arrested by police, not having any of the charges stick. But in order to be let loose, they had to agree to be gang raped by all the officers in the precinct. another young guy I just talked to and from the South talked about every time he's, you know, driving, sees the police, he has to take off his hat, change the radio station, tuck in his shirt, and try not to look so black. Kid from the Bronx I just talked to about all this, and he was saying, I hate this. I know what they do. I know what it means. This is why I try my best to never have to leave my room. No, this is a veil of terror. This is a veil of terror that generations have been strangled and suffocated with. And this is what began to be dragged into the light when people began to rise up. Starting in Ferguson, when the youth took to the streets and said, no, not this time, we're not going to take it anymore. And then spreading everywhere, all throughout society. People from other, you know, who aren't facing this every day, standing with them, stepping out with them, saying, this has got to stop. And we learn things about how people have to live in this great old U.S. of A. that they call. We learned that literally don't know the half of how many people they kill every single year. The youth who cannot even walk the streets or be in their own homes without being free of this fear and this terror. This has got to be the mission of a generation to put a stop to this. Lines began to form in the ashes of the rebellions, and that needs to be taken to a whole other level in October, where which side are you on becomes the message all throughout society, and a whole generation begins to shake everything up and begin to show the kind of courage that Mamie Till had when she was showed the body of her son. And she refused to have it touched up. And she said to the world, you're going to have to look at what they did to my son. The world is going to have to look at what they are doing to our youth. And everyone is going to have to face these faces and answer the question, which side are you on?
All right, welcome back. That was Noche Diaz, and he was talking about Rise Up October. All right, we're going to feature voices from that meeting that happened in Harlem just a couple weeks ago for the next couple of weeks. All right, so stay tuned on that one. If you want to get involved with Rise Up October, go to revcom.us or stopmassincarceration.net. All right, that just about wraps up the show entirely today. All right, and I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board op for today, Teddy Robinson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. I look forward to hearing from each and every one of you. We're going to go out now with Uprising from Muse. Talk to you again next week.